Hello, I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. According to the Centers for Disease Control, an estimated 20 million new cases of sexually transmitted diseases occur each year in the United States. Tonight, we'll discuss who's at risk to contact an STD and the treatment and prevention of sexually transmitted diseases, which are also known as sexually transmitted infections. Health Matters is a live weekly show here on Red River Radio where we invite you, our listeners, to join this discussion. You can call in and ask a question at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. We have three excellent guests with us tonight, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves. Starting from my right over here, let's meet.
Hi, this is Jerry Negron, Shreveport Infectious Disease Physician at Willis Knight in Piermont.
Welcome, Dr. Negron.
Thank you.
I'm Joseph Bocchini, Chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport, and a pediatric infectious disease specialist.
I'm Danielle Cooper, the Residency Program Director for the Department of OBGYN at LSU Health.
Dr. Cooper, Dr. Bocchini, Dr. Negron, thank you all very much for being here with us tonight. And this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The number for your calls or questions about sexually transmitted infections, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Bocchini, welcome back to Health Matters. If you don't mind, please review for our listeners what actually constitutes a sexually transmitted infection. I know there are a lot of different ways infections can be transmitted. As an infectious disease specialist, how do you explain to your patients what a sexually transmitted infection is?
So this is simple, straightforward. A sexually transmitted infection is one that is transmitted by any intimate sexual contact. And it includes a large number of bacterial agents, viruses, and even a parasite.
So nearly any sort of organism that can infect the body can also infect those areas of contact as well.
Right. So these are organisms that are capable of producing mucous membrane infections at any site and are capable then from local infection to cause sometimes very serious, life-threatening, and even fatal outcomes.
Oh, very important information. Thank you so much. Dr. Negron, welcome back to Health Matters to you.
Oh, thank you.
So I understand you're very interested in what's going on here locally in our region with regards to infections in general. Can you update our listeners a little bit about what's going on here locally in terms of the impact of sexually transmitted infections? And really, the Arklatex, as you know, our listening area goes all the way to southern Arkansas, a wide listenership in East Texas, as well as even eastern and central Louisiana. So in our region, what is there an update that you could provide?
Unfortunately, the update for all of the common sexually transmitted infections, HIV, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and several others, herpes viruses, is that the rates continue to increase, having started about 2002. And here's an example. In 2011, data from Baton Rouge, from our Department of Health and Hospitals, showed that syphilis rates, all forms of syphilis, in Louisiana, and this includes Arklatex, is the third biggest population in the state, there are about 202 cases for 100,000 population, compared to an average of about 99 cases per 100,000 population for the rest of the country. Gonorrhea, something similar, HIV rates and AIDS and new cases of that illness, something similar. And these rates of these illnesses dropped somewhat during the 90s and in the early 2000s started to rise again and continue to do so. And as I mentioned, because the Shreveport-Bossier area is the third largest population center within the state of Louisiana, we typically have the third highest number of cases after Baton Rouge, New Orleans, and then it's the Shreveport-Bossier area. And these affect all comers starting early to mid-teens, and really the rates don't drop off until about 65 to 70 years of age.
Now, if you look at other places in the country with similar demographics, and forgive me if I ask you a question that you're not familiar with the answer to, but if you look at other areas of the country with similar socioeconomic demographics, how do we rate compared to those?
Well, if you look at other southern states, Mississippi, Alabama, for instance, Florida, although that's really a mixture of different populations within that state, our rates for all these illnesses, except for maybe Mississippi, exceed most of our neighbors.
So we're outside of really where we should be in terms of our socioeconomic demographic.
Oh, we have many more. Our rates for these illnesses are much higher than we would expect. Our rates for these illnesses are on par with Texas, New Jersey, New York. Florida has a lot of these illnesses as well, although they're a much larger state population-wise. And these illnesses, whether it's the bacterial infections, viral infections, HIV is one virus in particular, the rates really started climbing again as we had the turn of the century time period after some improvement in the 1990s. And they really not have plateaued, much less leveled off or declined in the past few years. That just hasn't happened.
So the rate of increase is continuing?
Yeah. The most recent data that I saw, which is from about 2011, 2012, it was still going up.
Dr. Bocchini.
Well, just to add to what Dr. Negron just said, I have the data from the Louisiana Department of Health on STD and HIV rates in Louisiana up through 2014. And in 2014, Louisiana ranked number one in the nation, highest rate of congenital syphilis, was first in the country in rates of gonorrhea, second for HIV, second for AIDS, and second for primary and secondary syphilis, and third for chlamydia. So that really emphasizes what Dr. Negron said, that compared to other states, the rates are incredibly high in this state.
And you guys are infectious disease specialists, and as specialists in that area, would you consider it at epidemic proportions in Louisiana? Would you consider the rate of STIs or sexually transmitted infections at that level, or what constitutes an epidemic?
Well, from my point of view, these are incredibly high rates, and that there are subpopulations that are at high enough risk that you could say it's epidemic in certain populations.
Absolutely. I'd like to remind our listeners, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. We are discussing sexually transmitted infections. You can call and ask a question. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Cooper, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Sure.
So when you see a patient, particularly women, because that's what you take care of, tell the women in our listening audience what is important in terms of their health regarding sexually transmitted infections.
Well, one of the biggest things is that many of these infections are asymptomatic, and so it's really important to go in and get screened. If you have a new partner, if you even in a monogamous relationship, but potentially there are changes to that, you need to go in and get screened because you may not have any symptoms at all. Chlamydia is one of the worst offenders, and there's 80% of them don't have any symptoms. So that's probably one of the biggest things is go get screened. And then there can be lifelong complications from these infections that can lead to things like infertility, chronic pelvic pain, and then later in life or whenever you're ready to have a pregnancy and have a baby, these infections can be passed on to the baby. And so there's a lot more complications involved than simply just an infection that you take some medicine for and get better.
At what age should women undergo screening and how frequently?
As soon as they become sexually active, they should start that screening once a year. Unless they have more than one partner in a year's time, then when they've changed partners, they should get rescreened. And we screen everyone for chlamydia under the age of 25. We also, especially in our population, because there are such high rates in Louisiana, we are screening for both chlamydia and gonorrhea. Then we ask them and offer things like HIV, syphilis, and hepatitis screening as well.
Very good. Again, this is listener-supported Red River Radio, the number for your calls or questions about sexually transmitted infections. It's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Bocchini, I know you've done quite a bit of work with the local community as well as nationally regarding the human papillomavirus and the vaccination for that. Explain to our listeners, if you will, a little bit about what that virus actually is, what that infection looks like or doesn't look like, and how we can treat it or prevent it now.
Well, this is very important. Human papillomavirus is the most common sexually transmitted infection. There are over 7 million new cases of human papillomavirus infection each year in the United States. And because individuals who are infected may remain infected for a considerable period of time, it's estimated that over 20 million people are actively infected with HPV, human papillomavirus. It turns out that amongst those that are infected, most are, again, asymptomatic. They do not know that they're infected. Probably the most common clinical manifestation of HPV infection would be genital warts. So a certain percentage of individuals will have genital warts due to HPV. There are certain types of HPV that have the ability to cause cancer, and these are the ones that we're really concerned about. There are 13 types of HPV that can cause cancer. And HPV is common enough that anyone who is sexually active is at high risk of acquiring HPV. It's estimated that over 80% of individuals in this country will have been infected with HPV during their lifetime. The bad news is that there are over 30,000 cases of cancer associated with these HPV viruses that occur each year in the United States. HPV is the almost exclusive cause of cervical cancer. It causes a considerable amount of other cancers in the anogenital area, so penile cancer, vulvar, vaginal, and anal cancers are significant percentage of them are caused by HPV. And oral cancers are now becoming very common. 72% of oropharyngeal cancers in the United States are caused by HPV. The good news is we now have a vaccine that can prevent 90% of HPV-related cancers, and we need to give this to young individuals.
And Dr. Bocchini, I realize this is a really important topic, and we're going to cover it quite a bit more. So let's go ahead and start taking a couple of calls, and we're going to come back to HPV. But we're going to go to Chloe now, who is in Shreveport. Chloe, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Specifically about the Zika virus, what exactly is it? What do the symptoms look like? And can it be sexually transmitted?
I'm going to ask Dr. Negron to comment on the Zika virus.
Now, Zika, which is about 3,600 cases in the U.S. so far in territories, it's what they call a flavivirus. Most of us have heard of West Nile virus 10 to 15 years ago. It's in the same family. It's a mosquito-borne illness. It got famous in the last several months because in the summer in the southern hemisphere last year, we saw several hundred to several thousand cases, in particular in South America. And it led to birth defects, mostly involving the head of newborns with what they call microcephaly or small heads. And it can be sexually transmitted. There are a few documented sexually transmitted cases already within the states, but mostly it's a mosquito-borne illness.
That sounds good. Dr. Cooper, how does it affect the fetus? I think maybe it's worth reminding our listeners the the severity. Have we seen any Zika-related fetal anomalies here in the Arklatex?
No, as far as I know, there are no known cases.
Okay.
But these patients, you know, I mean, the entire world can travel. And, you know, patients, and part of that concern is that these patients may be coming from South America into this area, potentially have already been infected. And we screen those coming into the clinic who are pregnant. If they have been to certain and have been in those countries during their pregnancy, then we do some screening to try to evaluate it. And again, microcephaly seems to be the largest problem associated with these infants.
Dr. Bocchini, Zika, how would you rate Zika on the scale of important sexually transmitted diseases for us to really be concerned about in terms of, you know, this time of year?
Well, at this point, we don't have enough information to know how frequently Zika is transmitted sexually, but we do know that the virus is in semen, and we do know that the virus can be in semen for many, many weeks. We don't really know how long, but many weeks after an acute infection due to Zika. So not only do we worry about women who may have come from areas where Zika virus is being transmitted by mosquitoes, but we're also worried about women who are pregnant whose partner has worked in one of those areas and comes back home, because that individual may be carrying Zika and transmit it unknowingly through sexual contact. So the CDC guidance is very clear that if someone is pregnant and their partner has been in an area where Zika is being transmitted, that they should either refrain from sexual contact or use protection to prevent the potential for transmission of Zika. And so that's important at this time for travelers as well as people who have worked there.
You know, I mean, is this, Dr. Negron, a potentially smoldering pandemic, not only for the acute infection, but you're looking at, you know, with pregnancy-related fetal anomalies, these microcephalic children have a lot of needs. They have tremendous downstream, you know, impacts on the cultures and the, you know, the economics as well as the healthcare needs of communities that are affected. I mean, could this have a devastating effect in some areas?
Actually, probably not. And I say that because just this week in Science, which is a journal, a particular article came out where they estimated, based upon previous infections with flaviviruses, which is the general family for this thing, that between now and about maybe the next 5 to 7 years, many of the acute cases that we see are going to basically decline in a relatively short time, because a lot of the population will have been infected and become immune. So then we'll likely have just sporadic cases over the next year or two as the virus moves into new areas. That's where we'll have the news making a relatively small number of cases. If you remember West Nile virus, again, as a flavivirus in about 2000 to 2003, moving from the East Coast through the country towards the West Coast, many cases locally, many severe neurologic sequela after it, after cases, especially in older individuals, and then within 3 to 4 years of it moving into the Arklatex, it became just sporadic cases scattered through the year, because basically we became all infected and were immune. So something similar is likely to happen over the next couple years with this.
So you would estimate that the risk of an HPV-like phenomenon is quite low with a flavivirus like Zika?
Yes. Okay, HPV keeps going. Flaviviruses flare up and then they kind of peter out.
That's good news. All right, let's go to Stacy from East Texas. Stacy, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yeah, I was wondering, I don't know if y'all have already spoke about this, is there a cure for herpes, and how would someone go about discussing this with a potential long-term relationship, like a marriage partner?
Dr. Cooper, I'm thinking you probably encounter this infection in your practice. What would you tell Stacy?
Unfortunately, there is no cure for herpes. Once you've been infected, you carry that virus for a lifetime. Now, it is possible to try to suppress the virus and the amount of viral particles that are shed. If you have an active lesion, then the shedding is worse. The problem is shedding can also occur when there is not an active lesion. And so in order to protect your partner, consider suppressive therapy with medications as well as condom use.
Stacy, thank you so much for calling us tonight. Dr. Bocchini, would there be something that you would add in terms of herpes suppression chronically? Is that effective? Is that a viable way of controlling outbreaks?
As Dr. Cooper said, it is what is recommended. It is a viable way of preventing viral shedding. Long-term suppression is possible with drugs that are safe and very effective.
We have a call that's come in over the internet, or a question that's come in over the internet, and Dr. Negron, I'll toss this one your way. You gave us some statistics for sexually transmitted infections in the age group of 15 and older. The listener is asking, are there statistics for sexually transmitted infections in the age group less than 15? What's going on with that population?
The answer is yes, there are statistics. The reason I mention roughly mid-teens is because at that point you will start to see an uptick, if you track this on the bell-shaped curve, of all the infections that we are referring to, whether it's HIV, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia. You do get sporadic cases in slightly younger than that, and it really depends on when are the children and young people starting to have sex. So you will, but really by about age 15, many youth are starting to become sexually active, so that's where the bell-shaped curve really starts to grow.
Another question along those lines is, has the incidence in teens changed with the advent of the HPV vaccine? Have we seen drops in the rates of HPV infection in the region?
We don't have any regional data, but the national data that's available shows that now HPV vaccine has been available and licensed for 10 years. And the most recent data indicates that there has been a significant decrease amongst vaccinated girls in the carriage of the types of virus that are in the vaccine, the types of HPV virus. So we have evidence that the vaccine is highly effective amongst individuals who are immunized. In fact, in the most recent data from the CDC, looking at cohorts of girls in the age group that has been that the vaccine is recommended for, and that's age 11 and 12 for the routine immunization, and up to age 26 if they haven't been vaccinated before, and very similar recommendations for boys. There has been over a 50% reduction in incidence of HPV, the types that are in the vaccine, and of those who have received one or more doses of vaccine, it's down by over 85%. So the vaccine is turning out to be highly effective.
And Dr. Cooper.
Just to add to that, there's not regional data available, but there is data that shows there's been decreased amount of CIN3, which is the dysplastic process that leads to cervical cancer, and that clearly this vaccine has shown to drop those numbers. I think the problem we have, and this data is all coming from Australia, which has mandatory vaccination protocols, and the problem we have here is getting the vaccine to the people. It's very difficult to, and our levels of uptake have been very low considering other vaccination rates and other vaccines that we routinely use.
Now, Dr. Bocchini, speak, if you will, to that phenomenon that we see regarding access of, you know, the access is there to the vaccination, but uptake is low. Is that something that varies state to state or within our state? Or is that across the board in the country?
It does vary from state to state. There are some states that, and Louisiana is probably around 50% of girls have started their HPV vaccine series by age 17, and that's nowhere near where we want to be. And only about 30% have completed their three-dose vaccine series. And when we look at data for boys, it's even worse. It's about 30-some-odd percent have started the vaccine series by age 17, and only about 15% have completed the series. We need to do much better. And part of the problem, I think, is that people have not really made the case that this vaccine is really a cancer prevention vaccine. And so people really need to understand that this is an incredible opportunity to reduce your lifetime risk of cancer. And so the best time to give this vaccine is before children are going to be exposed to the virus. So this vaccine really needs to be given at the 11 or 12-year-old routine health visit that adolescents or pre-adolescents have. We're nowhere near there. And unfortunately, Louisiana has one of the highest cervical cancer rates in the country. And we need to address this issue as quickly as we can, because we have a really good opportunity to eradicate a significant portion of not only cervical cancer, but oropharyngeal and other cancers that are related to HPV.
So you mentioned a routine health exam in 11 or 12-year-old. And I've had a few of those in my past, and you know, I'm probably not going to get the Parent of the Year award by admitting this, but I don't know that 11 and 12 year olds get routine maintenance health exams. You know, I know my sons, they get sports physicals, and if my kids you know, want a day off of school, I'll make them go to the doctor. But I don't know that we're talking about the HPV vaccine in your average 11 or 12-year-old. Just to be honest with you, I don't know if it could be just me. I know it's hard to get kids, you know, to the doctor sometimes. So
you bring up a very important point. And actually, if it's low in 11 to 12-year-olds, it's even lower in 14, 15, and 16-year-olds. So it's better for us to address this issue at the 11 to 12-year-old visit. And parents and doctors together really need to focus more on making sure with any visit to the physician, not only routine health visits, but that sports physical you mentioned, or coming in with an acute medical problem, that may be a time to get vaccine. Vaccine may not be contraindicated during those visits. So every visit to the doctor ought to be a review of vaccine uptake and make sure that the child is up to date. And if they're not, it may be a good time to consider giving the vaccine while that patient's in the office, because you're right, you may not get another opportunity. So I think if the doctor's not mentioning this at the 11 to 12-year-old visit, the parent ought to be asking for it. We routinely recommend three different vaccines at age 11 to 12. One is a meningococcal vaccine, which prevents meningitis. The other is what we call Tdap, which is a booster dose of diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, and HPV. And all three of those are equally important. They ought to be recommended with the same strength at that same visit.
And so I understand, you know, vaccinations are mandatory in younger children. It, you know, it takes quite a bit of an activist mentality to avoid that situation. Has the HPV vaccine actually been studied in younger children? Is it possible to maybe capture more of the population if it were given when children are more likely to go to the doctor and during that standard conventional vaccination series, or is the immune system just not ready for it at that age?
Well, it's been studied in children as young as 9 years of age. So the vaccine is actually licensed at 9 years of age. So it can be given as early as 9 years of age if the parent and the physician would like to do so. It is safe and well tolerated in that age group. It has not been studied in children younger than nine.
Okay, thank you so much. That's good. That's good information. We're going to go back to the phones and talk to Karen from Shreveport. Karen, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask, how long after exposure to HPV does it take the infection to affect, you know, the cells in my body? So if I've been monogamous for, you know, 10 years or more, do I still, you know, am I still at risk?
Great question. Dr. Cooper, I would ask you to maybe field that question. So 10 years latency, is it still possible for someone to have HPV-related pathophysiology?
Possibility, yes. But most individuals will clear the HPV virus within 6 months to 2 years' time. So even though there's a very high population at risk for getting infected, the majority of individuals will clear it. Certain populations are at risk for not clearing it, though, as well. If they have an autoimmune disorder, HIV, and even smokers tend to carry this disease a lot longer, and some of them become chronic carriers. So it is absolutely possible to still have that problem. Now, if it's actually causing cellular dysplasia on the cervix or not, that unfortunately is not necessarily as predictable, and it depends on the type of HPV virus that you've been exposed to, and that's not routinely tested for. You know, the pap smear with HPV testing can detect some of them, but not all of them.
And as Dr. Cooper said, I think that the important thing is that women should follow routine recommendations for screening for cervical cellular abnormalities, independent of whether they've received HPV vaccine, because that's how those changes are found early enough to make decisions about how to manage them before cancer can develop.
Well, and the highest group of patients that are actually developing cervical cancer are the ones who don't come in. It's the unscreened population. And so, you know, even if you've had an HPV infection or not, or you don't know, if you're going in to see your physician and getting that pap smear done routinely, they'll catch it before it's a problem.
Here's a question that comes to mind. An adult who's undergoing a partner change and has had clear pap smears in the past, would it be reasonable for them to consider vaccination?
Well, certainly the vaccine is licensed up through age 26. It has been studied in women up to age about 45 and has been safe and effective in the women up to that age. So I think someone who is entering a new partnership, someone who has more than one sex partner, certainly could consider getting the vaccine with what we would call off-label, because it does prove to be effective in limiting infection under the circumstances. So if you're at increased risk, it's certainly reasonable to consider it and talk to your physician about it.
Before we potentially leave HPV for a little bit, one question also comes up is that, you know, male detection is basically not available, right? And so unless they have warts, they're asymptomatic. And you can't test, you can't do a pap smear right in a male. And so why isn't it that male vaccination is not mandatory? Because they're basically 80% of males are going to get the infection, we assume. And most of them will be asymptomatic. And so are we going to ever control the epidemic if we don't make it mandatory in males?
Well, there is a routine recommendation for males as well as females.
Right.
It's the same
right.
recommendation. There are only three states in the United States that have considered making HPV vaccination mandatory. And they have made it for both males and females. And actually in Australia, as Dr. Cooper was talking about earlier, that's recommended for both males and females. So I would make no distinction between boys and girls. I think the vaccine is equally important for both.
Well, and it's not just about protecting the female partner. You're preventing anal cancer, penile cancer, and oral pharyngeal cancer in the male. That's why it's indicated.
Yeah, and in fact, the data that the CDC now has is that the rate of oral pharyngeal cancer is increasing at such a rate that by 2020, it's expected that it may exceed the rate of cervical cancer. So oropharyngeal may become more oropharyngeal cancers of the throat, tonsils, may be more common by 2020 than cervical cancer. Now, part of that is because of the effectiveness of pap testing and taking care of and eliminating earlier lesions.
Dr. Negron.
I just wanted to add one thing. In terms of males and HPV, because we have a very large HIV-positive population, in particular men who have sex with men, some who are consider themselves bisexual, others consider themselves gay, There are some practitioners who practice what they call anal pap smears for the men who have sex with men, because within the HIV positive population, anal cancer is extremely common, and anal cancer actually is a sexually transmitted infection, can affect females as well. And in theory, if we ever had large uptake of HPV vaccine for both sexes, we could actually affect that as well, because I have a large cohort of HIV AIDS patients that I care for, and it's pretty common within that cohort.
Let's go ahead to the next call. Let's talk to Damon from Oklahoma. Thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
What is a medical thing? I want to ask about my daughter. Hello?
Yes, sir. Thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yeah, I've just caught the part of your radio program. I'm in my 50s, and I just had a little baby girl, and she's getting ready to turn 3 years old. But I'm wondering about this HPV. What is, I keep her shots updated, all that. I'm a single parent, but I just, what is HPV, and do I need to start this treatment at 9, and what else do I need to do?
Sure, we've been through a little bit of that. I'm going to ask Dr. Bocchini to summarize what we've discussed for you, and thank you so much for calling us tonight.
Okay, so I think you're doing the right thing by keeping your child up to date with vaccines and vaccine recommendations. That's really important because it prevents a number of different serious infections. Based on your interaction with your physician, you can decide whether to give HPV vaccine at age 9, or the routine recommendation is to give the vaccine at age 11 or 12 during their routine visit during one of those 2 years. And I think it's really important to recognize that at this point in time, 3 doses of HPV vaccine are recommended. So you give the first dose, you give the second dose 1 to 2 months after the first, and then the third dose 6 months after the first. And so you want to do your best to keep your child on schedule at the right age.
Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Negron, we have a question that was called in regarding HIV and the access to the medication Truvada for the treatment of HIV and the PEP and PrEP medicines for HIV. Are there physicians in the community that are familiar with those medications?
There are physicians locally, including myself, who prescribe Truvada for pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is PrEP. That's for a serodiscordant couple, meaning one is positive for HIV, the other member of the couple is negative. There are some primary care physicians locally who also will provide PrEP, and it's been available and very well studied over the last 5 to 8 years. It's very safe. On the topic of Truvada, because one component of that medication was recently reformulated, and they have a new combo pill similar to Truvada. The new combo pill is not indicated for PrEP. Won't get into too many names, but the Truvada, which is a dual combo pill, two medications, that is still our preferred medicine for PrEP.
Very good. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. My name is Dr. Randall Brewer, and our topic tonight is sexually transmitted infections. Our guests tonight include Dr. Joseph Bocchini. He is the chairman of the Department of Pediatrics and a pediatric infectious disease specialist at LSU Health Sciences Center here in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Gerardo Negron, an adult infectious disease specialist here with Shreveport Infectious Disease, and Dr. Danielle Cooper, associate professor and residency program director here in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at LSU Health Sciences Center here in Shreveport. You can call and ask a question. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. So, Dr. Negron, you were talking about preventive medications for HIV. What is the status of HIV in our region? Could you provide our listeners an update with regards to what's happening with HIV in terms of new cases as well as treatment options?
Well, as we briefly touched upon at the beginning of the hour, our rates for new cases of HIV and HIV and AIDS, which is a more AIDS being a more advanced form of the illness, our rates are about 33 to 36 cases per 100,000, and those are on par with very large states in terms of populations: Florida, New Jersey, California, New York State. So we have rates of HIV and people living with HIV, which is incidence, and new AIDS-defining illnesses within the HIV population that are far, 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 far above what we should have for a state of about 4.5 million people. So we have as many, we have rates, again, cases for every 100,000 of our population on par with these large states.
Now, is there a breakdown in terms of the demographics, age, sex, sexual orientation?
Yes. Unfortunately, the following is held true for a while. About 20 to maybe slightly less than 25% of our HIV cases are in females, so that's about 1 in 5. The other 4 in 5 are in men. Most of those are men who have sex with men, so either gay or bisexual, but there is a distinct subpopulation which identify as heterosexual. And within the state of Louisiana, which is about 32 to 33% African American, the African American population accounts for almost 80% of all new HIV cases within the state of Louisiana. The other two-thirds, roughly, of our population are Caucasian, with just a very small percentage of Asian, Latinos, Native peoples. The Caucasians make up the rest of the cases, and the other parts of the population are present in very small numbers, so it's hard to tell what the rates are there. But again, African American, men who have sex with men, and in particular the roughly 15 through age 24, so the young people, among the highest rates. So we have almost reverted to the rates in young people that we saw early on within the epidemic.
Very good information to have. Let's move on with some of the other sexually transmitted infections. Dr. Cooper, you mentioned when we were speaking earlier a number of sexually transmitted infections that you see in your practice, particularly trichomonas and chlamydia. How do women need to prevent and get treated for those? How would they detect infection?
So the best prevention is going to be using a condom for any sexual contact that occurs that could prevent the majority of these infections. Unfortunately, things like chlamydia may be completely asymptomatic. Now, if they have symptoms, it's usually abnormal bleeding, potentially pelvic pain, or a change in their vaginal discharge or an odor to their discharge. And certainly with any of those symptoms, I would tell them to go see their physician. Sometimes it can present with dysuria or painful urination. And again, they don't necessarily have to have any symptoms. So just for their routine annual exam, when they're going to see their physician, certainly the younger population, 25 and younger, should be routinely screened for these. But as your physician is doing an exam, if they see discharge, they need to go ahead and collect cultures and evaluate for potential infection.
So routine exams, and you're recommending not just yearly if someone has, if they're not using barrier protection and if they're not in a monogamous situation, then their examination should be, I would assume, more frequent.
Correct. Before they have intimate sexual contact with a new partner, they should be evaluated.
Okay, Dr. Bocchini, from the pediatric standpoint, what do you see as some of the more important advances that are coming down the pipeline in addition to the HPV vaccine in terms of STI infection?
Well, I think one of the things that is in process is work to develop a vaccine against herpes simplex. I think that there are some potential candidates that are being looked at. That would be a major advance if that was successful. And I think that's probably one of the more important ones at the present time. The and I think that one of the problems we currently have is that we're worried about gonorrhea because that organism has become resistant to multiple antibiotics over the years, and so it's very important that we control that infection by giving proper treatment for it. But I think in terms of advances, probably the next one would potentially be a vaccine for herpes simplex.
Dr. Negron, from the adult side, what do you see as some of the more significant advances coming down the pipeline in the treatment of sexually transmitted infections or prevention?
Well, one thing which we actually touched on, which is preventive for HIV, is for people to make wider use of pre-exposure prophylaxis, because it's fairly common to have a couple, whether it's gay or straight, where one partner has HIV and the other partner is negative, and it's really underutilized, although we know it is a very safe treatment. And that would be in conjunction with the positive partner taking his or her treatment, using barrier contraceptives. And in states like Louisiana, where we have such high rates, that if we utilized it more, which requires access to care, it could really make an impact on the transmission.
You know, whenever the HIV epidemic came about, the issue with needle stick transmission was a hot topic, you know, when I was in training. And, you know, I would be interested to see what the incidence of needle stick transmission in the healthcare. I know it's not a sexually transmitted issue, but do you know of any data regarding what the needle stick incidence, how many new cases?
Rates, I cannot quote you off the top of my head, but it's become fairly uncommon. And the following I can quote you, if you look at the breakdown for risk exposures for HIV, you can find nice pie graphs from the CDC on this. Usually 12 to maybe 15% of cases in Caucasian females might be related to injection drug use. The rest are all sexually transmitted. Very infrequent in terms of healthcare exposures, very infrequent in terms of exposure from transfusion of blood products, at least within this country. If you look at the males, it's even smaller in terms of injection drug use, 8 to 10%. So that still leaves us with 90% of in the males cases are sexually transmitted, whether it's male, men who have sex with men, or heterosexuals. So it's really truly a sexually transmitted infection. And a similar thing, hepatitis B within this country, unlike Southeast Asia, really is a sexually transmitted infection. And one thing which really has helped to control that is the fact that we have mandatory vaccination for the children. Now, adults, not depending on how old you are, you may have gotten away with not being vaccinated, which is a problem. But at least in terms of our younger generations, probably starting in the 80s, I believe, until now, most children get vaccinated early on. And I believe it starts actually before they leave the hospital as newborns.
Correct. You know, in looking at some of the information I compiled from the Mayo Clinic patient education portal, one recommendation, Dr. Negron, that is mentioned is the consideration of male circumcision. And I'll quote here, there's evidence that male circumcision can help reduce a man's risk of acquiring HIV from an infected woman in heterosexual transmission by as much as 60%, and that male circumcision may also help prevent transmission of genital HPV and genital herpes. Is that a discussion that family practitioners, primary care doctors, or even perhaps pediatricians should have with males regarding? Obviously, if you're a pediatrician having this discussion, you're probably going to say, let's get the HPV vaccine. But in terms of, you know, perhaps the population at higher risk for HIV transmission, is this a discussion that should be undertaken?
It actually is, because depending on what part of the country you live in and depending on the background of the medical professional, circumcision is more or less common. I happen to be from the Northeast, where it's very common. And it's after 36 years of the epidemic, we've seen data over a prolonged period where circumcision is associated with fewer risks for everything that you mentioned. And as you get older, phimosis, which typically affects older men where they cannot bring the foreskin, retract the foreskin, and basically the penile head becomes trapped, that's a fairly common illness of older men. So if we actually could decrease the comorbid illnesses, herpes, syphilis, and a few other things, that actually impacts the transmission of HIV. And when it comes to papillomaviruses, HPVs, which can affect the penile head, often men are not aware because they don't necessarily retract the foreskin to even look.
And I think that conversation even happens with the obstetrician delivering the newborn. Parents, and I frequently have parents come and they want to know my opinion about circumcision, and we talk about the infections and issues as far as, you know, it being a plastic procedure, an elective procedure, but many of those circumcisions are done in the hospital setting before the baby even goes home. But certainly, you know, that's something I think even as a parent I take into consideration with my child if I can help prevent something.
Sure, absolutely. We have time for maybe one or two more calls. This is a listener-supported Red River Radio, and we are Health Matters tonight. You can call 1-800-552-8502 to join our discussion, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. We have three guests with us tonight. We have Dr. Gerardo Negron with Shreveport Infectious Disease, also Dr. Joseph Bocchini with the LSU Health Sciences Center Department of Pediatrics, and Dr. Danielle Cooper, also with LSU Health Sciences Center Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. So a couple of the other infections that we didn't get to yet, hepatitis as well as syphilis. We haven't talked a lot about syphilis. Dr. Negron, if you will, emphasize to our listeners the importance of syphilis in terms of how does that present if one were to contract that infection.
Well, to start off, syphilis in the Arklatex area is extremely common. It's been very common. And typically, depending on what form of sexual activity you are engaging in, the first stage of syphilis is you may get swollen lymph nodes and may have a scooped out ulcered area appear a relatively short time after a new encounter with an infected individual. And the ulcer, unlike herpes, doesn't hurt. And if people may not even notice it if it's in the back of the mouth, within the anal canal, or within the vaginal canal. So people may not actually notice it. And the scary thing is that if you don't notice it, it may actually go away. The problem is that it will probably show up again a few weeks later in a more disseminated infection with a particular spotty rash and enlarged lymph nodes where the organism has disseminated through the body. And within the Shreveport-Bossier area, seeing these different stages of syphilis is fairly common, all of which are very treatable, though. And the other bad thing about syphilis, because of the damage to the skin that it does, it creates a very good portal of entry for HIV. That's why these illnesses tend to travel hand in hand.
We have huge rates of syphilis also in the pregnant population, and that's being passed on to their babies. We have extremely high rates of congenital syphilis. I think we were number one in congenital syphilis, at least in 2013 data from the CDC. During pregnancy, we're screening women three times for syphilis in order to try to be aggressive and treat it. The problem is there's a significant portion who just don't come in for prenatal care, and these tend to be the more effective infected babies.
Dr. Bocchini, in the last 60 seconds or so, tell us how does syphilis present in an infant? in the newborn?
Well, just like in adults, it can be completely asymptomatic all the way to a very severely affected infant born with severe lung, liver, and bone marrow dysfunction, and it can be a fatal disease for the fetus. If the fetus is severely affected, pregnancy may be lost. And so, as Dr. Cooper said, we certainly have seen infants who have had mild to very severe manifestations over the course of the last few years.
Thanks very much to Dr. Gerardo Negron, Shreveport Infectious Disease, as well as Dr. Joseph Bocchini with LSU Health Sciences Center, as well as Dr. Danielle Cooper, also with LSU Health Sciences Center here in Shreveport. It's been great to talk to you all. We certainly will welcome you back at some point in the future. As you know, Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its employees. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance tonight provided by Mr. Wally Derleth. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation, as well as the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and a gift from Kit and Lisa Gamble. Please join us again next Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.